Good evening, everybody. I welcome you once again to Amnesty's monthly membership call for May. So hello again to all Amnesty members, member leaders. I see a lot of you have called in. Let me extend a special welcome to this evening for any new guests who are calling in for the first time. And I have spoken to a number of you, so thank you for being here. As always, the intent for these calls is to provide a forum for communication, open communication between members, member leaders, groups, and we make a space happen for member-to-member communication sharing. So we're glad you're part of it tonight. We have a slightly different direction for our call this evening. For anyone who's called in before, our recent calls have focused on death penalty in Arkansas, our refugee crisis, the Muslim ban. But tonight we'd like to acknowledge AI's birthday month. Now, while this isn't a party, it's a space that we can take perspective, look back, and acknowledge this long path that we've traveled, 56 years, and to give testimony to the success of the organization itself and its members, and an opportunity for us in this time, we can see a turmoil and shameful rollbacks of human rights, to stop, to reflect, to remember what we were and are still able to do, and to recommit our energies to facing future challenges. So we're going past, present, future. Now, this is also a chance for us to tell our stories. I'm going to ask everyone again to mute your phone, anyone who's called in. So while I was investigating this call, the more members I spoke to, the more stories I heard. And I have been impressed in my long time here with Amnesty, members who have been active with us for decades. And I'm also impressed with our new student leaders and young voices stepping up, taking bold, creative action. So they're our future. Who's just called in, please mute your phone. Please mute your phone. Okay, so as I was saying, our youth student leaders are our future. My name is Edwin Gore. I am membership coordinator at Amnesty International in the Member Leadership and Training Unit. Okay, I'm sorry. We're having some problems here. Could everyone please mute your phone? Okay. So my own Amnesty story, I will tell you that, started decades ago. Let me see if I can find this person on here. Sorry, everyone. Patient. All right, so we've stopped. That's good. My own Amnesty story started decades ago, and this was during the time of apartheid in South Africa back in the 80s. And I had become frustrated, really angry, and I felt I needed to do something about it. So it just so happened I came upon a public service announcement for Amnesty. I joined Group 9 in Manhattan, and then eventually I moved on to staff. Now, my story relates then to our first speaker, who is also from South Africa.
We're still getting all of that sound in the back. It's really hard to hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Let me see if I can, I can't figure out who this is. Are we still getting them?
Yes.
Yeah. Hello?
Hi.
See, that sounds like a speech. I mean, your phone, are you sitting next to your computer?
What do you think this is?
I think it's reverb on your end. Are you sitting close to a speaker?
Am I what? I'm sorry.
Sitting close to a speaker.
No, just my computer. Anyway. So is this coming from me? All right, so let me take a moment to introduce you to our speakers for this evening. They are Ann Burrows, Chairman, AIUSA Board of Directors, Abe Bonowitz, State Death Penalty Abolition Coordinator for Delaware and Ohio. I'll figure this out. Ellie Henza, student activist coordinator in Ohio, and our very special guest speaker for this evening, Mr. Albert Woodfox. And, of course, you, the members, member leaders of Amnesty, and I invite you to share your stories tonight. So before we begin, I ask two requests. When you speak, please state your name, where you're calling from, and any role you play in Amnesty in your organization. And so everyone can hear clearly, please remember to mute your phone when you're not speaking and avoid using speakerphone. And please remember to speak directly into the phone. So, great. You know the ground rules. Let's get started. So, Anne, could you introduce yourself and lead us off?
Sure. Thank you, Ed. Good evening, everybody. I'm Anne Burrows, and I'm the chair of the Board of Directors of Amnesty. So I'm delighted to be with all of you, especially so because we're celebrating Amnesty's birthday, our birthday. As Ed said, we turned 56 on Sunday. So what he did, he's asked me to share some of the highlights of our history and some of the milestones that mark the journey that we've taken together. And he's also asked me to talk a little bit about my own experience as an activist and my own journey where I am now. And as I reflect on our history, on Amnesty's history, obviously these are the high points that have meaning to me, and everybody on the call, you know, may have different perspectives or have different issues that they would want to raise up during the questions and conversation later on. But as I reflected on this, there were several issues that stood out for me. Firstly, and obviously the most obvious, is the incredible impact that we've had on the lives of so many individuals, but also how profoundly Amnesty has influenced and shaped the human rights landscape and that matrix of international human rights standards and policies that we now take for granted, but also how many generations of activists have come of age in Amnesty. So I think most of us know where we began, how Amnesty started, but for the benefit of those who don't, and because it's a wonderful story to repeat, and it's like a mantra that we tell on our birthday, is the story of how we started. We began in London in 1961 when a British lawyer called Peter Benenson read a newspaper story about two Portuguese students who'd been jailed for raising their glasses in a toast to freedom. So he was pretty outraged when he read that, and he wrote an appeal that was published in the Observer newspaper in London. It was called Forgotten Prisoners. And in it, he urged readers to write letters on behalf of people who were imprisoned because they had taken a stand to protect human rights. And the response was enormous. The article was published in several newspapers around the world, and thousands of people wrote letters. And so a movement was born, and so Amnesty was born, and so this culture of writing letters was born. And it was about 2 years later, in 1963, that the first prisoner was free as a result of an Amnesty letter-writing campaign. He was a Ukrainian archbishop. It was a powerful moment, especially when we realized that he was to be the first of literally tens of thousands of prisoners who walked free because of our work. So after having focused, you know, for the first, I guess, 9 years or so of our history on working specifically on prisoner cases, the next logical step for us was to expand our focus campaigning against torture, which we did in 1972, and we launched our first global campaign, which eventually resulted in the UN Convention Against Torture in 1984. And, of course, to this day, this continues to be a key platform of our work, both here in the U.S., globally. And then, for me, and I think for all of us, the next high point was when we were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1977. And that was obviously a major validation for our careful work and our contribution to global protection of human rights. And in their citation, when they gave Amnesty the award, the Nobel Committee wrote, and I'm going to quote it because I think it's very powerful. the defense of human dignity against torture, violence, and degradation constitutes a very real commitment to the peace of the world. So that statement was true in 1977, and it's as true now, as it was then. And then the next major milestone in our work, certainly for me, was in 1980 when we started working to abolish the death penalty. And at that time, when we took up that work, there were only 9 countries that had abolished the death penalty. And today, I believe 140 countries have done so. Of course, the U.S. hasn't, so we still have an enormous amount of work to be done there. But for all of us on the call and those of us who've been around for a very long time, you know, we will understand just how unbelievably the work that we've done to abolish the death penalty, how powerful that has been as a sort of unifying force for us. And certainly we remember the campaign to stop the execution of Troy Davis, which, you know, to my mind stands as one of the galvanizing campaigns in history. Not that it was successful, we weren't. But it did unify activists and non-activists in the U.S. and across the globe against the death penalty. It was very, very powerful as a next step in that campaign for abolition. You know, there's so many things that we take for granted in our work, the rights that we work on behalf of, but, you know, they didn't just come to us overnight. So, you know, many people won't know that it was only until 1991, during our 30th anniversary, the 30th anniversary year, that we started working on prisoners of conscience who were jailed because of their sexual orientation. And that was a decision taken at the ICM in Yokohama in 1991. And that began the mainstreaming of our work on LGBT issues. You know, similarly, in the 2000s, you know, we included reproductive rights, you know, which enabled us to further strengthen protection for women and girls. And of course, in the aftermath of 9/11, you know, it led us to look at how we should be thinking about preserving human rights within a framework of national security policies. You know, we focused on torture within national security. We focused on, started the campaign to close Guantanamo. You know, and of course, the work that we did then, you know, has continued to be a thread run through the work that we've done here on national security issues, and it continues to be a thread that runs through the work that is done by amnesty sections in other countries that are facing the same issues. And then, of course, in this decade, we also made very, very significant strides in the way we looked at police-related violence, you know, the work that we did on the ground in Ferguson and Baltimore, you know, how that was able to sort of add to, you know, the body of work that we were able to look at in the U.S. And that whole concept of, you know, how we began to look at this whole notion of bringing human rights home, how we began to look at that differently. We'd always done that work in the U.S. We had for a very, very long time. But we started to sharpen a lot of the strategies and tactics that we began to look at. And then, of course, the other thing which also we've had to look at and confront is the unprecedented refugee crisis in the Middle East, Europe, and Africa over the last few years. And then, of course, I think, I'm sorry, can everybody mute their phones?
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you're not on mute, try not to breathe into the phone or, you know, hold it close. It's causing noise. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. And then, of course, you know, 2017, you know, is going to go down in, certainly in Amnesty's history, and certainly in the U.S. history, where we, you know, sort of mobilized across our country and, you know, across the world to stand up to the rollback of human rights by the Trump administration. And their policies that are fueled by discrimination, bigotry, and prejudice. Of course, you know, there's an enormous amount more work to be done there, but I think that in the way that we've been able to, you know, effect a pretty massive mobilization campaign against the Muslim ban, No Ban, No War campaign. It's been enormously powerful. I think that it's captured imagination, and I think, I mean, already we've seen, you know, there's some been very, very successful rollbacks against that. But, you know, when I look back on all of this, I have to say, I mean, history may prove me wrong, but I have to say that for me, in many respects, the late 1980s, I wasn't around in Amnesty then because I was still in South Africa, but I think that the late 1980s was a game-changing decade for us because it was in the years of the Amnesty concerts, the massive human rights concerts, the Conspiracy of Hope tour, the Human Rights Now tours. There were concerts in 28 countries in all that were headlined by, you know, major, major artists of the time, Sting, Peter Gabriel, Bruce Springsteen. And the reason why it was so important, because there were several things that happened. The first thing was that human rights became a household concept, and Amnesty became one of the most recognizable NGO brands in the world, alongside the UN and the International Red Cross. And we also grew to 500,000 members in 15 countries. In 50 countries, which doesn't seem a lot given where we are now, but at the time it was massive. And I think that most importantly for me in all of that was that we actually, Amnesty birthed a rights movement and a rights culture. So the very fact that we created the space for this rights culture to grow and flourish, I think has been one of our greatest successes and will certainly be one of our greatest legacies. And, you know, when I reflect on my own history with Amnesty, you know, it started about 30 years ago, you know, many of these developments, many of these milestones in the developments of this rights culture have really been sort of part of my own history, which started off as when I was a young activist in South Africa during the very darkest days, towards the end of apartheid, but when repression was probably at its height. And I joined the resistance movement to fight against the policies of racial segregation and discrimination. And at that time in South Africa, as in many, many countries of the world, you know, we faced police brutality, military killings, troops in the townships, disappearances. It was a time when torture was routine, when torture was not the exception, when all resistance and protests were criminalized, when journalists were banned and censored, and when the foreign press was expelled. And what I was part of an organization that was monitoring state repression, and we smuggled out information in diplomatic bags to Amnesty researchers in London. And I was arrested in 1986 along with, you know, thousands of my compatriots, and I was held under laws that allowed for indefinite detention without trial. So I was first held in solitary confinement for several weeks. No charges were brought against me. And the state was working up treason charges, which at the time carried quite dire consequences. So one day my lawyer came to see me, and he wrote on a piece of paper that Amnesty had taken up my case. And I knew with absolute certainty then that I would be free. It's not a case of if, but it was when. And I also knew that I would be protected. And then fast forward several years, I came to this country and I joined the staff of Amnesty, and I was on staff for, you know, eight and a half years. I joined the board 5 years ago and I've been the chair for 4 years. And I'm telling you all of this because what we faced in South Africa at the time seemed insurmountable, but it wasn't. We did win. And I think that really is what Amnesty's story is. We face these things that seem absolutely insurmountable. But that power of resistance and that power of solidarity can never be underestimated, and that's who we are. It's that power of individual action, but it's also when that individual action comes together in a collective. That's who we are, that's why we're powerful, and that's why we celebrate, and that's why we celebrate all of the victories. So thank you very much. Ed, over to you.
Thank you, Anne. That's wonderful, and I really appreciate your sharing your story. That's what I want from everyone tonight, to hear your story. So does anyone have any questions or comments for Anne at this time? Any questions, comments, anything? Okay, very good. So, Anne, do you want to turn it over?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Ed. So, it's my privilege now to introduce our next guest to all of you. Albert Woodfox is with us this evening, and as you all know, he was the longest-serving prisoner in the U.S. to be held in solitary confinement. He was freed on his 69th birthday in February 2016, 44 years after he was placed into solitary confinement. He's, of course, no stranger to the Amnesty family. Our members and our supporters in the U.S. and countries across the world have worked on Albert's case for years. This is as part of the Angola Three, along with Albert's comrades, Herman Wallace and Robert King, and most recently when Albert was part of the Right for Rights in 2015. But today we have the privilege and the opportunity to hear him talk about his own story and to understand something of his incredible courage and his faith in humanity that carried him through those dark years and that have set his course on social justice and prison reform. So, Albert, over to you. It's our honor and it's our privilege to have you with us.
Albert, are you there?
Oh, no.
Did we lose you, Albert?
Albert, if you can hear it, dial *6.
Let me see if I can do it here. Okay. I have somebody muted here, and I'm trying to unmute them here. Albert, are you still with us here?
If you have his number, maybe you can try to three-way him on your line, Ed.
Yeah, I don't, actually. Let me see what I can do. Well, in the meantime, we could move on. Hope he joins us again. Is that Albert? Okay. All right. So can we just move on? Part of the stories that, you know, I was looking at were the fact that we have so many long-term members. We have people who have been with us for decades. Was that Albert? Did you join us? Okay. So members who have done lots and lots of work for us, who have been working with us for decades, and Abe Bonowitz is one of them. So I would like to bring him onto the call. He's done long-standing work for our death penalty program, and he has much to share with us, so.
Well, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I want to make sure that, okay. Albert, you didn't join us here, did you? Okay, go ahead, Abe.
All right, and if you all are on the call looking for Albert, we're going to try to get him back on, so don't go away. And thanks very much, Edwin, and greetings to everyone, and especially my old friends Ann and Ellen and my Ohio colleague, Ellie. I'm honored to be part of this call. And I mean that when I say my old friends Ann and Ellen. Actually, Ellen I don't think is on, but we thought she might be. But that's one of the things that's kept me in Amnesty International all of these years. Some of the best friends I have today are people I met, worked with over the nearly three decades that I've been part of this organization. I met Ann when I moved to California in 1994, and she was working in the Los Angeles office, and the other person I keep mentioning, Alan Moore, we thought might be on, she ran the Urgent Action Office for a long time out of her house in California, or in Colorado with her husband, Scott. And it's a little fuzzy, but I remember that my first annual general meeting in Chicago, because it was just a week or two after the Tiananmen Square massacre in China, and I guess that would have been in, I think, 89, and or maybe it was after the Burmese student uprising in 88, but in any case, yeah, this was part of my own awakening as a human rights organizer. I want to back up here and say that before 1987 or 88, I really had no idea about Amnesty International or the concept of human rights and what that really meant until one day when I was assigned to photograph an employee event at the big corporation where I worked. One of the employee clubs had brought in a man to share his experiences escaping from the refugee camps in Cambodia. And I did my job. I got the photos I needed, and I headed out to get my lunch. But I'll never forget this because it was one of the most effective organizing tactics I've ever seen. Dave Dalton, who worked at the same corporation, was also a member of Columbus Group 87, the Columbus Adoption Group here in Ohio, and he had placed a simple stack of brochures. And those who've been around will remember this one, the one with the blue cover and the quote about what happened when the first 200 letters arrived in prison. Just a simple 8-foot banquet table with a single stack of brochures sitting by itself in the middle of an otherwise empty table. And I picked one up on my way out, read it up with my lunch, and decided right then to join. And in that moment, changed the entire direction of my life. I went to my first group meeting on the campus of the Ohio State University. I was surprised when the speaker was a lawyer who represents Ohio death row prisoners. I must have missed that part of the brochure because I argued with her. I did not agree that the death penalty was a problem or a human rights violation. I set out to prove those amnesty people wrong, and in doing so, I ended up proving to myself that I was wrong. Well, I was tolerated, and I would get up at meetings and say that maybe I was working against executions in places like Russia or South Africa, but not here in the United States, where we have the best justice system in the world. Of course, by the way, those countries have both abolished the death penalty quite a while ago now. So I kept going to meetings, and one day Jim Laird, the OSU's group coordinator, got up and gave us an update. He reminded us that we had all written letters to China about that government, or asking that government to free a man named Paul Lee Hsu, who had been in prison for his religion. Here it was 4 or 5 months later, and Jim announced that Paul Lee Hsu had been freed. And I'll never forget the feeling I got at that moment. I had simply written a letter, and it had helped free a man from prison. And that's what kept me going, doing this work all of these years. I've had that feeling a few more times, never like the first time, and I'm still in search of that feeling again. And really, that's what I tell people when I encourage them to join is, you know, you got to do this work because sooner or later you're going to help free someone, and it's going to be incredible. It must have been in 1990 when Jim called me again to tell me that another member of the group had had a death in the family, and she could not attend the regional conference, which that year was in St. Paul, Minnesota. This was back when you could get on a plane with someone else's ticket. I was free, so I went. It was at that conference that I finally heard the facts that changed my mind on the death penalty. Professor Michael Endres from the Amnesty chapter at Xavier University in Cincinnati laid it out using Ohio statistics. He said, if you kill someone in Ohio, just don't do it in Franklin County, Cuyahoga County, or Hamilton County. That's Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati. Because you have to kill in a county to afford a death penalty trial in order to even get the death penalty. For me, the fact that money and race and politics and geography matter more than the severity of the crime highlighted the unfairness of the system and made me decide that, you know, the way it was working was not cool and I needed to work against it. But I still hung on to the idea that some people deserved it. It was the facts that changed my mind. And then meeting people like Bill Pelkey, the founder of The Journey of Hope from Violence to Healing, that changed my heart. Bill was for a time the state death penalty abolition coordinator for Indiana, but he also did not always agree with me. He supported it when the 15-year-old girl who killed his grandmother was sentenced to die. Then one day he had an epiphany and changed his mind, and he's another amnesty leader who's also a national leader in the movement to abolish the death penalty. So the facts changed my head and the journey changed my heart, and Amnesty International has been the common thread through all of my work over these years. In the mid-1990s, I started a now-defunct national group to lift up the visibility and activism on this issue. I co-founded Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. I was the field manager for New Jerseyans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, whose director, Celeste Fitzgerald, was also Amnesty's SDPAC. That's the acronym for State Death Penalty Abolition Coordinator. New Jersey was the first state to legislatively repeal the death penalty since 1964. And I'll tell you, it's always a thrill when they pass your bill. And we did it in New Jersey in 2007. And I've been a part of all the legislative repeal victories since then, and so has Amnesty. We abolished the death penalty in New Mexico in 2009, in Illinois in 2011, in Connecticut in 2012, in Maryland in 2013, in Nebraska in 2015. I'm still the Delaware SDPAC, where we passed our repeal bill twice in the Senate before that state's Supreme Court ruled it to be unconstitutional last year. And we're working hard right now to shut down an attempt to bring the death penalty back in that state. I'm also the SDPAC in Ohio, where I live now, and where we're on the verge of passing a bill to prohibit the death penalty for defendants who are severely mentally ill at the time of the crime. I was glad to see Amnesty's leadership on the Troy Davis campaign, which ended with his execution a few years ago, but not before Amnesty led the effort to make his name known around the world. I don't think there's ever been a larger march exclusively against a specific execution than the one that Amnesty organized in Atlanta. Amnesty's program director then was Laura Moy, and she was such a visionary. She lifted up people like Troy's sisters, Martina and Kim, and so many others. I think Martina was also an SDPAC at some point. More recently, last fall, I worked with the Amnesty groups and leaders in Oklahoma against a referendum to write the death penalty into that state's constitution. And just last month, Amnesty made it possible for me and a number of other SDPACs to be on the ground in Arkansas as we fought that state's attempt to execute 8 prisoners in 11 days, 2 at a time, on 4 different nights starting on Easter Monday, just so they could use up their supply of execution drugs before the drugs expired. The lawyers stop executions. Let's be clear about that. And my hat's off to them because they managed to stop 4 out of the 8. Our job is to raise awareness and mobilize people. Amnesty helped deliver more than 250,000 petitions to Governor Hutchinson. He didn't listen to us, but we made it painful for him. There's so much more I could say. So many stories. I want to share with you that I've started a new organization with another SDPAC, Scott Langley, from New York. It's called Death Penalty Action, and you can check that out at deathpenaltyaction.org. And we're working with Amnesty people all over the country. I've worn other hats, too. I was the Central Ohio Area Coordinator, and I served on the AC's Steering Committee. I was a member of AI Members for Lesbian and Gay Concerns Steering Committee when Amnesty was still struggling with that issue. And I was on the board of directors for 4 years. That was all a lifetime ago. I still write my letters, I still pay my dues, and for all the ups and downs, I'm still glad to be a member. Finally, I want to add that it's up to us to tell our own story. What I mean by that is that we have to... document our work, save copies of what we create, and intentionally submit them to the official archive for Amnesty International USA at Columbia University's Center for Human Rights Documentation and Research. It's a phenomenally important resource for correct information about AIUSA's past and present. It can be used not only by academic researchers, but by board members and group members, planning staffers, grant makers, etc. So I've been on the AIUSA Archives Advisory Committee since it started, and you can contact me or Ed for more information, and maybe we can ask Ed also to send out a link to the webpage in the next email. I look forward to your questions. Thank you again, and you can always reach me at abe@deathpenaltyaction.org. Thank you.
Great. Hello. Thanks, Abe. Hi.
Ed, this is Marina for Albert.
Oh,
he
hi.
He can't get back in. The call, he's been trying. I don't know what to do about that.
If you could give me his phone number, I can loop him in on a three-way.
Okay. Hold on. I don't know it, of course. I have to look it up because in my phone. And I...
Thanks, Marina. Okay, while we're waiting, does anybody have any comment or question for Abe about the history and his experience with death penalty? Anyone?
Well, Ed, this is Carolyn up in Vermont. I had a question, Abe, and that is, have you had experience in states where the death penalty is abolished, but due to the crime where the perpetrator took the victim across state lines into a, into another state, that then the federal death penalty overrode the state death penalty law? Can you talk a little about that?
Ed, can I suggest that if, this is Anne, if Albert is on the line, that we move to Albert and then we can get back to more broadly, because we've only got 20 minutes left on the call.
Do I turn it on, Jan?
Hello?
I don't think, are they on the call yet? I don't think so.
Anyone there?
Albert?
Yes.
Oh, hi, Albert.
Okay, yes. Right ahead.
Very good. Albert, okay. Welcome to the call. We're really glad. Sorry you couldn't get back in.
I'm sorry for the technical difficulties.
Sure, no problem. Well, you received a ringing introduction earlier.
I could hear everything.
Okay.
But when I started to speak, and then I could hear everyone saying, hello, Albert, I realized there was some kind of problem, you know.
Okay. Well, welcome back. And the floor is yours. You're welcome to speak with our members now. Thank you.
Okay. Well, first, I'd like to extend revolutionary greeting to the members of this conference and the members of the Amnesty International. As was stated, as a result of my membership of the Black Panther Party and my political activities and what was known as the worst prison in America at the time, the Louisiana State Prison at Angola. And eventually a correctional officer was found murdered in one of the dormitories, and I, along with Herman Wallace, became prime suspects automatically. We were placed in solitary confinement on April 18, 1972. And at that time, Robert King, who was the third member of the Angola 3, was transported to Angola. And because of his membership of the Black Panther Party, he was placed in solitary confinement, where he was held 29 years on the investigation of the murder of Brent Miller, even though he was 100-something miles away from Angola at the time this murder took place. As was stated, the three of us, Robert C. Us, was 29 years, Harmon 41, and myself 44. Of course, we lost Harmon 3 days after winning his freedom. And Robert won his freedom and was released from Angola in 2001. And unfortunately for us, we had a group of friends and former Panthers who made up a support committee called the International Committee to Free the Angola Free. And, it was because of their hard work, and eventually members of Amnesty, Anita Roddick, found out about the struggles of the Angola 3, to not only be get out of solitary confinement, but to be released from prison. And eventually Amnesty accepted us as political prisoners and and supported our case, and I think that made a world of difference, because now the world knew what was happening to three men down there, the Angola 3, and in spite of American government's claim that there are no political prisoners, I'm here to refute that and say that they are political prisoners. Myself, Harmon, and King were political prisoners. There are still political prisoners being held in the system, prison system in America. I think that when Amnesty decided to support us with the worldwide respect and prestige of Amnesty, and I think that changed the course of our case. I think that the people in the government of Louisiana, as well as in the Department of Correction, began to realize now that they could no longer continue to hide what they were doing to us and other men and women in the Louisiana State Penitentiary. I can't begin to express my gratitude to Amnesty and its members and its supporters for the support that they gave A3. And there's no doubt in my mind, if not for that support, then I may still be in prison. And I want to thank everyone for that support. And wherever I go, I continue to call for the support of Amnesty, and I will continue to do so, as well as, you know, other things that Robert and I are trying to advocate for, such as the end of solitary confinement, legalized slavery in America under the 13th Amendment of our Constitution, and institutional racism, and so many other ills that plague the world now. And I would just like to end by saying thank you so much, and I will continue to support and call for the support of Amnesty. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We really appreciate having you here. Does anyone have a question or comment for Albert? Would you like to say something?
Well, I personally, hello?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. You're hearing me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, okay. All right. I just dialed in. That was a wonderful speech and a session of ideas. I appreciate that gratitude and whatnot. But it is our duty to help each other. I would say it is our duty to help each other. So I personally would like to say, I think this has to be a positive impact on, improving the quality of life, so the world, and so on and so forth. And you're a wonderful person, and Amnesty International is a wonderful organization. So I'm with you, brother.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Anyone else like to say something?
I have a question. Rakia in New York. How you doing, Ed?
All right.
Rakia, thanks for joining.
Woodstock. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
I am honored to speak with you. I have a question. Absolutely. In your opinion, being a staunch and supporter of Amnesty, which is so beautiful and amazing, and speaking on that publicly, what do you think organization like Amnesty International, in light of the crimes that's happening domestically and also internationally, should be focused on and doing now?
Well, Amnesty is like the conscience of the world. I think that Amnesty makes humanity aware of some of the evils that exists in this world, and the need to to unite and fight against these evils. Unfortunately, a lot of these evils take the shape in the form of other men and other women, and in some cases, young people. I think Amnesty has proven, since its founding, that there is a need for organizations like Amnesty. There is a need for the people who are members of Amnesty and the people who support Amnesty. It is the only way that we can change humanity and change the world as a whole.
So to reduce the suffering, obviously, in the world or whatnot, as the case is, it's just to bring people into the scope of realizing the realization of the respect that is necessary within each categories of ethnicity or religion or whatever the case is. So to change the world is actually to reduce suffering. This is just to improve the quality of life. So I would say that is the aspect, the vision behind the organization. Human rights cause. I mean, Mr. Benenson, a very wonderful person. I would like to give my praises to his late gentleman, Mr. Peter Benenson, and what it sought to establish. Like, the only thing I would say is following it was 1960, I think it was, Patrice Lumumba. If he had actually been there before, I believe he would have been alive. So, it should have been there before. And also, I don't think that the world should have to actually go through these kinds of things to be able to realize the importance of what human rights is. So that it's unfortunate, but people should actually have that duty, that respect in themselves for what human rights is. And it might even sound a bit forced to say that, I believe, as the vision of Amnesty said was, are you hearing me? Hello? Hello?
Yes.
The vision of Amnesty was always, our work will always continue so long there is a problem of suffering. Actually, I would detract from that and say it shouldn't be Amnesty, it should be in existence, because these problems shouldn't have to exist, but it is, as you said, necessary. It is necessary.
Okay, thank you. Any comments? Last comment for Albert?
Hello?
Would you like to say,
hello?
Albert? Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello, Mr. Wilcox.
I just wanted to say to Albert that, you know, he's an inspiration to many people of our generation, and we are grateful for his presence in organizations like Amnesty International, and we're hoping that cases like his will no longer ever exist anywhere in the world, and we all want to share our inspiration from him to do more work for people in need. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your comment.
Thank you.
Okay. Any last comment?
Yes, I have a question. Can you hear me, Ed?
Yes,
is Kurt
okay.
Whitaker and I.
Hi, Kurt.
Mr. Woodfox, thank you so much for speaking with us today. I wanted to ask you, of the messages you received from Amnesty International, what kinds of sentiments or ideas in them were most heartening to you during your years in solitary confinement?
Well, for me, you know, as was stated, in 2015, I was featured in the Amnesty Right to Right campaign, and I got so much mail. I mean, boxes of mail every day, and I'm still reading the mail. I've been free now a little over a year, and I have, you know, all the mail that I got, even though I wasn't able to read all of it. But I think the letters that touched me the most were those letters from the children. You know, I got a lot of mail from kids in school and who, I guess, their parents or relatives were members of Amnesty and had shown their support behind the call for not only the Angola Free release from solitary confinement, but our freedom. And I think those letters touched me the deepest and they meant the most. Because as we know, children are so honest in the things that they say and do. And that really, it meant so much to me that these kids had rallied to our support.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, madame. I'm crying. She's a mother. Bobo.
You coming? Okay.
Hello.
Do you have something to say? Okay. So, no final comments from anyone?
Hello?
Can you hear me? Hello? Hello?
Yes. Hello.
Don't forget about Emma.
Who are you first?
Ed, don't forget about Ellie.
Yeah, I know. I'm wondering if people can just stay on a few minutes longer. We can run this call just a little bit longer than normal. We've had some interruptions.
Mr. Wolfhoff?
Yes.
Hi. I'm just wondering, what is the best or the most appropriate way to deal with people in your experience?
I'm sorry, I can barely hear him. I'm picking up a lot of background noise.
Yes, I understand. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Hi. May I ask, if you were in a situation of, you see now, the right wing, the left wing, the inappropriate attitudes of people towards each other, may I ask simply, how best is it to think of this and go around peacefully and activate or actively get rid of the bad vibes that are going around? How did you deal with yourself in these environments? And that's my question, sir.
Well, of course, solitary confinement was the most horrible situation I can imagine. I think it is, solitary confinement is probably the most non-physical form of torture that you can inflict upon another human being. And, I'm fond of saying that, I read some of the writings of Nelson Mandela, and from that I came away with the belief that if the cause you supported was noble, that you could carry away the world. And so I saw my struggle to build a better humanity as being a noble cause, and that allowed me to resist the negative things that I was hearing or witnesses and stay focused on what I was trying to do, which was become a better human being and to contribute to the betterment of the human humanity as a whole.
Well, thank you for that. I do understand to an extent, and I do appreciate you answering my question. Thank you so much. My name is John. I'm in the UK, and I'll leave you now. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thanks, everybody. I think we'll let Albert rest now. We're glad you finally were able to join us, and we'll just move on a little bit. Albert, you can stay on the call if you like. I'm going to introduce the speaker here. We have representation from a longer-term member, and it's just very important always to remember our young leaders and our students, because they're doing very good work, very creative and dynamic work. And I want to introduce Ellie Henze, who's a student activist coordinator. She's done some marvelous work in her high school. Ellie?
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
Glad to have you. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm here to speak because I've always harbored a passion for human rights advocacy on a global level. And so during my junior year of high school, I decided to join the global campaign for fighting injustice and
I decided to become a member of the nonprofit organization, Amnesty International. And so this goal was, this was an uphill battle in itself because I live in an extremely conservative community. And so I created a group at my high school and began advertising the beginning of the club by hanging faculty-approved posters that I designed around the school. And so along with the meeting information on the poster had a photo of an anti-war protest that denounced the war in Gaza. And in the photo, one of the background signs held up by a figure had read, Free Palestine. And so because of the community I lived in, within the next day, dozens of distressed parents and religious leaders had contacted the school in demand of reparation for the quote-unquote anti-Semitic nature of Amnesty International's club poster and the organization as a whole for their stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And so the principal informed me that because of the fear and animosity that the poster caused, I would no longer be able to hold an Amnesty International student group on campus. And so the intent of the club was not to offend any religious group, but the exact opposite. I introduced Amnesty to my school to unite people of all backgrounds. And although I regret unintentionally offending my peers and the community, I'm grateful for my access, for the access to resources that allowed me to expose the injustice at my school. And we had to go to the media to get them to cover the story in order to expose injustice. And the story was featured in the Washington Post, the Atlantic, and other national news outlets. And the attention it gained led to the reinstatement of the club. And since then, I've worked with Amnesty International as the president of my student group. And because of the people I've met, the connections I've made with amazing activists all over the Midwest and from around the country, and because of my passion for the organization and its work, I decided to become a student activist coordinator after just having become involved with Amnesty. So I'm now an SAC for the state of Ohio. And I began working with Amnesty International a year ago, and my start was rather abrupt, putting me in a unique position to defend the organization that I knew so little about. But if working with Amnesty has taught me anything, it's about the importance of knowing your own rights as an individual. Human rights work now is crucial more than ever in spreading awareness and educating the public about their rights as citizens. It's important for individuals to know their rights in order to achieve their own potential and positively impact the world in turn. And human rights abuses occur worldwide and put innocent populations of people in grave danger every day. And this calamity does not even begin to compare to the unacceptable treatment of men, women, and children in other countries. But as privileged citizens of the globe, it's our responsibility to expose the injustices and to hold the leaders accountable for their actions. Because being denied the ability to have an amnesty club is a frustrating violation of the First Amendment, but there are serious injustices occurring all over the world threatening the lives of countless people who don't have these resources to fight back, as I did. And so during trivial times, it's important to remember the overarching issues that are weighing on the globe and how we as individuals can impact them, even when it's not the most popular thing to do. And these are just a few things that I've taken away from Amnesty International in the short time I have been involved with the organization. But thank you all for listening to me today, and thank you so much for everyone's testimonies.
That's great, Ellie. I was just so impressed with what you did to establish your Amnesty group. I think it just shows a lot of spunk and a lot of strength, and that's what we need now. Does anybody have a question, comment for Ellie? Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I live in Trinidad and Tobago, West Indies. My name is what she says is actually quite true about injustice and the amount of lack of information, people have something human rights and so on and so forth. In my country, is a very important thing to actually formulate and manage. I have been trying since 2000. It has been difficult, and all of these papers have actually turned down any articles relating to information of a group. So, Magna Carta, well, our country is Commonwealth, and mostly based on Magna Carta, right? So one of the things about that is some of these countries that human rights can be told, not automatic. So it does not kind of still win the kind of tension between human rights has been designated, and automatic. The confrontation there is the result, is what results in this lack of communication from this group, I believe. That is my belief. Yeah. And this is something that is causing frustration. Anyway, I believe that that could actually be confronted. I would put my opinion here. You have to actually get into the system itself and change the system. So, it's a nice idea to cut in. Whereas, you would have to actually be in that uphill climb. And so the whole point of it is to try to increase the
interest. Okay, thanks. Okay. Any final comments we have here? Well, I'm sorry we didn't get... Yes, go ahead.
My name is Jenna. I'm in Washington State. And I would just like to say for an inspiration to our youth. You go, Ellen.
Okay, thanks. We really appreciate the comment. Well, I really wanted to spend some time with the rest of our members and hear your stories, so maybe we can postpone this. I don't know why I'm getting this feedback. But I just wanted to say thanks to everyone for sharing their stories tonight. Now, as we've come to this point over 56 years, we're able to see that our efforts are needed now more than ever. We look forward to the work ahead, the future. So in the next year, Amnesty will be channeling its efforts on defending human rights defenders. Now, human rights defenders face threats, intimidation, imprisonment, and governments around the world, which include the United States, prevent them from speaking out or they imprison them because of their peaceful activism. Mm-hmm. So we also cannot avoid work on refugee and migrant rights. We campaign on behalf of individual refugees and migrants worldwide to secure their safety and freedom. So in recognition of our 56 years and with our eyes on the future, for all of us who are left, let's take a brief moment. So raise a glass or whatever you're holding in a virtual toast. So first, here's to Peter Benenson for getting us started. Then here's to Amnesty and its continued strength and fight for freedom. And then here's to all of you, your stories, your work that made it all happen. And here's to our future. So cheers, everyone. Once again, I would like to acknowledge our distinguished speakers, Anne Burroughs, Abe Bonowitz, Ellie Henze, and especially Mr. Albert Woodfox for joining us tonight, and thank them for sharing their stories with us. So thanks to all of you. You might have noticed we attached an Amnesty birthday video to the email you received today. It's a testament to you and to all the work that's been done. Remember, too, that all the monthly calls are recorded, and they will be listed in the Activist Resource Community, ARC, on our website. I welcome you to join us again next month, and thank you. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thank you. Thanks. Good night.
Good night. Thanks.
Good night. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you very much, Ed. Enjoyed that.
You're welcome. Glad.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
All right. Yes, okay. Thank you very much. Yes.